Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Counterintuitive thinking about bike safety. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Some advocates are arguing that wearing a helmet while cycling can actually make things more dangerous. Hear the case they're making.
In politics, why do the two main political parties in Washington seemingly behave so poorly? We'll have an explanation.
On the tech front, a review of those new voice-activated wireless speakers that acts as your personal assistant.
And the latest endangered business, your neighborhood bar.
Over the past decade, roughly one in six neighborhood bars has closed down. So, the old neighborhood bar, like I keep thinking of Cheers, that kind of bar. Those are really closing down.
Market Watch reporter Katie Hill on why your favorite watering hole is closing its doors for good. That report later in the hour. Well, why can't the two main political parties behave the way they're supposed to? Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib says one of the reasons is because the two parties are not what they used to be and not what many of us persist in imagining them to be. Jerry, how do you see it?
Well, you know, you kind of wonder why the Republicans are drifting in the direction of people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson when they're supposed to be lining up behind the traditional kind of Republican choices like Jeb Bush or Scott Walker, and why the Democrats aren't sort of lining up to do what everybody kind of thought they were going to do, which was to crown Hillary as the nominee without much fuss or muss. But that's not really what's happening. And what I tried to do is to try to take a dive into what the two parties are and look at the way they've changed, which might explain why they're not behaving in the way they used to. It's because the face of the parties have changed. You know, the Republican Party is more blue-collared, a little more downscale, much more southern, and more dominated by real movement conservatives, not just nominally conservative people. And the Democratic Party has become more liberal, more northeastern, more coastal, more economically diverse. And, it's not the same party with a bunch of moderate Southern Democrats who picked Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Those people are kind of gone. And so, it's not surprising they look in different directions. And so I think part of the answer to why the political picture looks so strange is that the parties really aren't what lots of us persist in imagining them to be.
Right. So how or why did this happen?
You know, this has been actually underway for a generation or so. It happened for a lot of reasons. I think a lot of moderate to conservative Democrats, particularly in the South, drifted away from the party over time, largely because of cultural issues. I think that the face of America is changing, and that's created a kind of a divide. The Democratic Party is much more diverse than it used to be, and the Republican Party, is still kind of what it was, which is a party more dominated by whites, just more dominated now by white Southerners and older people, because, one of the interesting things I discovered is if you go back to the 1990s, you found as many young people who grew up in the age of Ronald Reagan, calling themselves Republicans, as you did Democrats. Well, now it's vastly reversed. It's almost twice as much Democrat as Republican because you have a new, more diverse set of young people who are firing the Bernie Sanders phenomenon in the Democratic Party. So these are all changes that have been developing over time.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. His piece is called "The Two Parties Aren't Crazy, Just Changed." All right, so I was looking at the numbers in your piece, and at least with one survey, it said something along the lines of, 12% of Americans consider themselves very conservative, and then another 12-13% consider themselves very liberal. How does that translate into, say, the current leaders of the presidential primaries?
Well, first of all, those are the figures of people who call themselves very conservative or very liberal in the Republican and Democratic parties, respectively, in 1990. Now those numbers have doubled. You have twice as many Democrats proportionally calling themselves very liberal and twice as many Republicans proportionally calling themselves very conservative. So it just tells you that there has been polarization, not just in general, but very much at the base. And so the people who feel very strongly about their party and their ideology tend to be the people who drive the political process because they're the most vocal and the most involved. And so it tends to push politicians from the Republican Party to the right and politicians from the Democratic Party to the left. And you're certainly seeing that in the fight over which kinds of Republicans will be in charge of the House of Representatives, or at least the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. And the kind of more conventional John Boehner-like choices are sort of falling out of favor, and the more movement, younger, more movement conservatives who have a different outlook on what it means to be in power are asserting themselves, and that's produced the chaos we've seen in the Republican ranks in the House over the last week or so.
All right, so if, any idea or any guess as to what this might mean in terms of the way the parties look 5-10 years from now or longer?
You know, that is a really good question. I do think we're seeing something this year that will help us answer that question. I don't know that it's possible to know for sure just yet, but it does. It really does appear that the Republican Party is becoming less of a Wall Street party and more of a Main Street kind of Costco party, you know, where people's views about what's happening to the culture is important as what they think about the party's economic policies.
Thanks, Jerry. Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
With Kuda Sign, paperless e-signing is a no-brainer for any business that requires legally binding signatures fast. That's because Kuda Sign offers everything you should expect from an electronic signature solution for just $1 per month. Kuda Sign cuts document turnaround time as much as 90%, thanks in part to its number one rated mobile app. And Kuda Sign's secure cloud stores documents for on-demand tracking and retrieval. Get KudaSign now for just $1 per month. Go to KudaSign.com. That's KudaSign.com.
Ever consider how strapping on a bicycle helmet could actually make your ride more dangerous? Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman says some cycling advocates argue that helmet regulations can create long-term health problems. Rachel, what's this about?
Well, essentially what a lot of cycling advocates are arguing is that the long-term health, public health losses of fewer people cycling outweigh any sort of like short-term gains from bike helmet laws. And this is for a few reasons. One, because bike helmets deter a lot of people from cycling. I should say helmet laws, because people have a perception that cycling is maybe more dangerous than it is. They might be reluctant to hop on a bike for a short trip if they don't have a helmet with them. And this has a larger ripple effect of fewer people exercising. So and I want to emphasize this is not about whether you should wear a helmet or not. I think most people agree that it's a good idea to wear a helmet. It's just about whether requiring people of all ages to wear helmets is a good idea.
Right. So is there any evidence at this point to this kind of counterintuitive thinking that it's actually more dangerous to have helmet laws on the book?
Well, there's an interesting case in Australia, which several decades ago passed mandatory helmet laws for all ages in several states. And what has been found, essentially, is that they were better at decreasing cycling than decreasing injuries, head injuries in particular. So in other words, what researchers have found is that there really wasn't a significant decrease in head injuries in the wake of these helmet laws passing, but there was a significant decrease in adults and children cycling. So this is sort of surprising. One thing to remember here, which is what more and more research is finding, is that there is a strength in numbers benefit to cycling, and that is that, and this is another counterintuitive point, and that is that the more people are cycling in a given area, the less likely crashes are to occur. And that seems strange, right? You think more people, more chances to crash, but what ends up happening, researchers theorize, is that drivers become more accustomed to seeing cyclists. They slow down a little bit, they start looking out for them, and they change their behavior and make it less likely that they're going to collide with cyclists.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. Her piece is called "Do Bike Helmet Laws Do More Harm Than Good?" All right, so the folks that then are arguing against the laws think that all laws should be gone or keep it in place, say if you're under, I don't know, the age of 14, for example, or they just think all bike helmet laws should be gone?
I think there's not universal agreement. Some people say, hey, you know,
people are very well aware that helmets have some benefit. Parents can decide whether their kids should wear helmets or not. They don't need a law. Other people say we absolutely need laws for children because they can't make these decisions on their own. Their brains aren't fully developed, and we should send the message to them that they absolutely have to wear a helmet. I don't know what the right answer is. I think that there is some evidence in this country and in Australia that bike helmet laws for children have decreased the number of youth riders. And in some cases, for instance, there have been statistics that have shown that head injuries among children and deaths among children have gone down in states with helmet laws, but that research has not always looked at whether that was a result of declining ridership.
Oh,
of course,
wow.
If there's fewer people riding, you would expect probably fewer people to get injured.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really complicated issue. I think the bottom line is it's still a best practice to wear a helmet, but if you're taking a very short trip on a bike path and there's no traffic and it's a sunny day, you're probably not at risk if you're not wearing a helmet. If you're riding in traffic in a city, then it's a little bit riskier.
Yeah, yeah.
To not wear a helmet.
Wow. Do you ride?
I do. In fact, I'm a city bike member in New York, and I do sometimes ride without a helmet.
Wow. See, I don't trust myself. Like I feel like there's so many things to watch for. I better have something on my head, just not to worry about cars or other cyclists or pedestrians. I just feel like I'm going to hit that stone one day and like bang off the guardrail. I better have a helmet on.
Well, I have to tell you, ironically, even though this argues against helmet laws, doing this research sort of reminded me, I probably should have a helmet around and ready to wear for when I hop on a city bike, because it does, they do provide some protection from some head injuries.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. I'm a danger unto myself sometimes. I tipped over in my driveway the other day. I couldn't unclip out of my bike. Just tipped over, right on my shoulder. I'm not sure my head actually hit the driveway, but I did have my helmet on just in case. That's why I wear it. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Could you use a few extra bucks in your wallet in the coming months? Of course you could. Tackle some cost-effective home improvement projects. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
If you want to save money this winter, you may want to take a close look at your home's energy use. Here with some home project ideas that can save you money is Pat Eswine of Kiplinger's. Pat, what are some of the easier things a homeowner can do to cut energy bills?
The first thing you can do, and probably the easiest and cheapest thing you can do, is to beef up the insulation in your home and to look for places around your house where you can use caulking to fill gaps. If you do those things, you can cut your energy use this winter and be more comfortable too.
When do you need to call in the pros when you're sealing your exterior?
If you want to add insulation, say in your attic, you may be able to do that yourself with some online guidance. But if you're not really handy, if your attic is not easy to move around in, then you probably do want to call in a carpenter or handyman who can help you take care of that.
Another place where air escapes or gets in when you don't want it to is windows. How do you test your windows to see if they're good?
You'll probably notice that if you place your hand on the inside of your windows, on the inside glass, in the summertime it'll be hot, and in the wintertime it will be cold. In the wintertime, you may notice if there are gaps between the sashes or around the windows, you may notice draft. If you have occasion to cover your windows in plastic in the wintertime to keep the drafts out, you'll notice the plastic filling up and deflating as the wind blows. Windows are a tricky thing because they are a very expensive project. You can cut your cost if all you need to do is replace the sashes. If the frame of the window is rotten, that's going to increase your expense because you're going to have to replace the framing as well.
Another major expense could be an old furnace or boiler. When do you know you should change that?
The general rule of thumb is if your furnace or your boiler is 15 years old or older, it's probably at the end of its useful life. Even if it's still running, you're probably wasting a huge amount of energy. So if it's at least 15 years old, it's probably a really good time to replace it. Typically, if you have a heating and air conditioning system that are combined, you'll probably end up having to replace the air conditioning at the same time, too.
We're hearing a lot about solar power these days. What about going for it and really going solar or leasing solar equipment?
There's been a lot of interest in solar because of the federal tax credit equal to 30% of the cost of installing a solar electric system in your home. That credit ends at the end of 2016, so time's a wasting if you're interested. Depending on the location of your home and how much sunshine it gets, solar can be a very effective way to offset the cost of your electricity. But it takes a while to get the payback on that. If you lease it, you can eliminate that upfront cost, but you really have to do the financial analysis on this to figure out whether it's going to be worthwhile for you or not.
Yeah, just in general, if you're planning to move soon, I would assume that some of these things are not as tempting to do as others.
Sure, because it takes time to recoup that upfront cost, whether you're replacing the furnace or boiler or whether you're thinking about replacing windows or installing a solar system. So if you're moving soon, you know, maybe within 5 years or so, you probably don't want to take these things on. Yeah, that's true.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Pat Eswine from Kiplinger.com. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You always want to look great, but don't have the time or the patience to go shopping. With Trunk Club, you never have to set foot in the mall again. Trunk Club takes the hassle out of shopping by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million with all the new fall styles. At trunkclub.com/morning, all you have to do is answer simple questions about your style, preferences, and size, and then you are assigned an expert stylist. They curate clothes from the best premium brands, and you approve what you like. Just like that, a trunk arrives on your doorstep filled with hand-picked clothes that are perfect for you. Try them on, keep what you like, and easily return what you don't in their prepaid trunk. This is not a subscription service. You only pay for the clothes you keep. No hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, their entire styling service is free. Even the shipping. You only pay for the clothes you keep. To take advantage, go to trunkclub.com/morning. One more time, that's trunkclub.com/morning for a trunk filled with clothes you'll love wearing. Week 6 of the NFL season this weekend. Here's a preview from Craig James, former NFL player and ESPN analyst, who now hosts a podcast called Airing It Out with Craig James. It's distributed by Compass Media Networks, the same company that distributes this program. Craig summarized the season to date.
Well, I think the fact that the New England Patriots, and I'm not being a homer because I played for the Pats, the fact that Brady went through all of that Deflategate, their organization went through all of those distractions, is remarkable that they come in there. They lose Revis in the secondary. They replace him. They've got just, it's remarkable that they've started off as hot as they are, not just playing well, but really playing dominant football. And so I would say New England, kudos to those guys and Belichick for keeping their focus on playing football games.
Well, I know as a Jets fan, I don't like to dwell too much on the Patriots, so we'll just move on from that subject. No, you know what? I hear what you're saying, and I hate to admit it, but, man, I love to watch Brady compete. Man, he just competes.
Man, Gordon, it's what, you know, it truly doesn't matter if what kind of fan you are. You probably don't like him if you're not a Patriots fan, because he's so competitive,
yeah. But
he's good for football because the guy is showing us how the position is supposed to be played.
All right, so the Eagles and Chip Kelly, what's happening there?
I'm a big fan of Chip's, following him back to when he became the coordinator at Oregon. I don't know. Culture in a locker room is very important. We, again, go back to the whole idea of team sports. And it's not about individuals, it's about a team believing in themselves. And we're seeing that right now they just don't have it together in Philadelphia.
Does that fix itself, or is the locker room issue a real problem there that's not fixable?
Oh, wow. In order to fix a locker room, it only takes one or two really bad guys to contaminate the whole locker room. So perhaps Chip Kelly started last year weeding out those that were not all in for him. And then, again, you know, it's going to take time for his offensive scheme to come together. My friend Eric Dickerson, my old teammate at SMU,
yeah.
Eric and I've had him on my podcast a few times. He thought the move to bring DeMarco Murray there was horrendous. Not that DeMarco's no good. It doesn't fit. DeMarco's a downhill zone stretch runner, and they needed LeSean McCoy, a shaky guy in space. So I think they made a mistake there.
Wow. No, I never considered that. All right, how about finish up, too, with some of these teams, I guess, that are sort of surprising me, like the Ravens at 1-4, but by the same token, the Bengals at 5-0.
Yeah, I'm going to say with the Bengals, that's to me more impressive. And I think Andy Dalton is finally playing and having the success in big games like against Seattle last weekend, so that he's got his whole locker room support, listening to the players talk about Andy, Marvin Lewis talk about Andy, a very talented player, committed. They know how good he is, and now he's starting to make the plays in the big games. They are a balanced team and very dangerous. And I'll mention one more that you're familiar with, the Giants. I wrote them off after a week or two in the preseason. I said, "There's no, I don't see any hope in the New York Giants,"
okay.
And here they are leading the NFC East.
Well, thanks to Tony Romo and really the Eagles, right? I mean,
yeah. That's football, right?
Fair enough.
They took advantage of it.
Right. Do you have Dalton's number? I need to text him and tell him to get Jeremy Hill more touches because he's my starter on fantasy. I can't have Giovanni Bernard taking all those carries.
I told you, isn't it hilarious? These players, they know too that there's a lot of folks counting on them in their fantasy leagues, and it's kind of fun to follow along. But Andy Dalton, he's a good one.
I hate fantasy because I cheer for all the wrong reasons, right? I'm a Jets fan. I work part-time for the Giants. And then, like, Sunday night sometimes, I'm like, come on, Tom Brady, deliver this victory for me. And I'm like, wait a minute. I can't be cheering for Brady. What's wrong with me? Fantasy screws up everything.
And for me, I play in a $5 league, so it's all for $5, and I'm going crazy. And that's why I could never be a gambler. The thrill of victory never exceeds the agony of losing.
Craig James, the podcast is called Airing It Out with Craig James. He jokingly said, if you're looking to him for fantasy advice, do the exact opposite of what he recommends because he's horrible. 21 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Hard not to have seen the TV commercials lately for the Amazon Echo, the voice-activated, cloud-connected wireless speaker, which talks back to you and acts kind of as a personal assistant in your home. A review of it from Rob Enderle, tech analyst and principal of the Enderle Group in San Jose. Rob, what do you do with it?
Initially, much like Siri, what you do is you ask her for things like the weather or to play music or something along those lines. But the idea of Echo is to really interface with a lot of other stuff. And there are ways to get it to interface most recently with Insteon and home automation, and I've got an Insteon home. And there is a really weird way to get it to work with Sonos through a SmartThings hub, which is a hub that is built by Samsung these days, and get it to work. But there's where the problem kind of resides, because the more you try to connect it to other stuff, the more difficult it is to get stuff done. So that with Insteon, it's connecting to the Insteon hub, which then controls the lights, but you've got to get the light name exactly right.
Yeah.
So if you had something like I do where it's middle switch, upper hallway, you've got to use that same phrase, turn middle switch, upper hallway on, and I've got 71 switches, and there's no way in heck I'm going to remember them all.
Right.
The other thing with Sonos is because you're going through the SmartThings hub, all you can do is turn the speakers on and off. You can't, for instance, at least not with Echo, you can't have Echo start playing music and then start routing that same music to the rest of the house. The Sonos system is arguably very separate, and at the end of the day, it's much easier to actually use the Sonos remote, which runs on Android and iOS and Windows smartphones and tablets, to control the devices. The Echo thing is it's not even fun the first time.
Wow, We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. His piece is called The Problems and Promise of Amazon Echo. So at this point, then, do you anticipate that this is sort of like an early adopter problem and eventually it'll work like a charm? Or is it kind of involving three different pieces really complicated?
Well, it's really trying. So here's the thing. So my wife loves the product. I mean, she thinks we ought to have one in every room. I'm not so convinced. But she mostly just uses it for the music on and off. It's a voice command speaker, and she's happy with that. And she asks it about the weather every once in a while. That's pretty much it. And that's good for her. So I will point out one kind of fun thing, because if you've been watching TV, Amazon does an ad for the Echo product on a regular basis, and where it starts giving commands on the screen, and of course the Echo in the house hears the command, and because it's voice independent, and starts trying to do what the thing on the TV is doing at the same time. And what's kind of funny is about half the time it doesn't get it right.
Oh, that's funny.
So the one on the TV is working just perfectly, but the one in the living room is having issues. But I think one thing that kind of showcases one of the problems with one of these products that is speaker independent, in that a radio program or a TV program or something else could issue a command, and the Echo could, in your house, could go ahead and execute it, and if it was connected to cameras or a few other less friendly things that you'd want to turn on and off automatically, you could have issues.
I think I would be an estimated 10 to 12 years away from beginning to adopt what Rob Enderle has in his home, beginning with the Amazon Echo. 14 minutes now in front of the hour.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot.
If one of your pastimes is gathering at the local watering hole to watch sporting events or catch up with friends, that routine is more and more in jeopardy. Neighborhood bars are closing at an alarming rate. MarketWatch refers to it as the Chipotlefication of America. More from reporter Katie Hill, bearer of bad news.
Over the past decade, roughly 1 in 6 neighborhood bars has closed down. So, the old neighborhood bar, like I keep thinking of Cheers, that kind of bar, those are really closing down. The data shows that although there are 334 new bars opening in the U.S. every month, 609 are closing at the same time. So you can see there's just a big discrepancy. The neighborhood bar is going away.
Wow. All right. Cities, suburbia, where's this happening?
Everywhere across the country this is happening, because here's what's happening. Consumers, millennials, are kind of driving this trend. They really want not just a place you go grab a beer and maybe some fries. They want a place that serves drinks and food. So the Chipotles of the world, the Smashburgers of the world, that kind of thing is really replacing the neighborhood bar. Not just chains, by the way. I'm picking on Chipotle because everyone knows it. But, these a little more upscale food, they've got a lot of drinks. That's the new trend. That's what's replacing your old neighborhood bar, where you get a pint and you sit on a maybe slightly sticky bar stool, and you know the bartender, and he's been there for 15 years. That thing is really getting replaced by the Chipotles of the world.
Wow. All right. So that makes it seem, though, that these neighborhood bars are not making any kind of adjustment to this trend with easy food.
And unfortunately, many aren't, because that's why they're closing. Because, by the way, it's hard to see this trend when you've been in the neighborhood and you say, I've been here for 50 years. This is just how I do it,
Yeah.
And that's just not what the new consumer wants. And, everybody probably knows their favorite neighborhood bar, and plenty of people. I wrote on Facebook asking people, if you had a neighborhood bar that shuttered. And, so many people wrote to me, oh, my gosh, this one's gone, this one's gone, this one's gone. So clearly they're not making adjustments. The data show it. Anecdotes show it. It's sad.
Wow. We're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. Her piece is called Why Your Favorite Neighborhood Bar is Closing. It's interesting, and I saw embedded in your story, too, kind of the Starbucks angle to all this, with the question, will Starbucks become your new neighborhood tavern? Because some of them are serving booze, right?
That's right. They're just jumping on this trend too, right? They like Chipotle and all these other places have all this market research, to back up the fact that exactly what the Nielsen data is showing is that people want a sort of a little bit more upscale experience of, they want different kinds of drinks and they want, gourmet food along with it. And Starbucks is jumping in that too. And Chipotle and all of them are really, they have the same research. They're doing the same thing.
Wow. All right. So are you seeing it where you are, for example, the whole closure of the local bar thing? You're a city gal, or you were a city gal at one point, right?
For sure. You know, I once lived in New Orleans, and one of my favorite bars, Mermaid Inn, closed down, and I now live in New York, and we're seeing it everywhere. And yeah, they're being replaced by fancy wine bars that serve tapas or those kinds of things. But we're seeing it across New York, across New Orleans. I heard from friends in San Francisco, and then my dad, who lives in Asheville, North Carolina, same thing. It's just no matter who I talked to or where they were, they had seen something of the sort.
Thanks, Katie. Market Watch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. It's 7 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Huffington Post has a clever story about the songs that were hits the last time the Blue Jays, Royals, Mets, and Cubs won the World Series. The last time the Blue Jays won it in 1993, of course, featured Joe Carter's Game 6 home run. But what was just as memorable was Mariah Carey's Dream Lover. For the Mets, it was 1986. Mets over the Red Sox in 7 games. Cyndi Lauper's True Colors was on top of the Billboard's charts.
But I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors.
And for the Royals, 1985, right? 7-game series win over the Cardinals. And Whitney Houston was wowing us with one of her all-time greats, Saving All My Love for You. For the Cubs, 1908. The year Take Me Out to the Ball Game came out.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me something.
By the way, Take Me Out to the Ball Game was not number one on Billboard because there was no Billboard yet. Nice job, Cubs. Cubs-Mets for the National League Championship Series. It'll be the Royals and the Blue Jays for the American League title. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.